Buttheads, welcome back to Bob Zemeckis is not a butthead. Today we're going to talk about 1941. I'm Richard.
I'm Kyle. And Richard, we have a special guest who is joining us, an old friend, but new to the pod. My brother, who is it?
Clarf.
Cliff, yay!
That's right, I'm Cliff Bogart. Yeah, Cliff, you are my brother. You have been on another podcast with me for a while. Cliff, say hello to the Buttheads.
Hey, Buttheads. I've always considered myself a Butthead. I related to Butthead more than Beavis, of course. I thought Kyle was more of a Beavis growing up. So, yeah, and I think I was meant to be on this podcast more than you were, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, and Cliff is also on this today because he is, of the many people we know, the biggest John Milius enthusiast.
Oh, yeah.
And that is relevant to the podcast, Richard. Why?
Very much so. Well, this story was his idea, and he was big friends with Bob Zemeckis and Bob Gale when they were first starting out, and the idea of 1941 is a Milius idea, and he hired these two clowns to go write it, and then Spielberg said, hey, this is going to be my next picture.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly like that. So, relevant. Came out in 79, so he had Zemeckis said, I want to hold your hand, which we loved. Poor at the box office. Then he wrote this for Spielberg. This was a huge disappointment at the box office, critical failure for Spielberg. And then he had Used Cars, which was also box office failure. So these were the three that kind of put him into a little bit of jail.
Yeah, which is why we decided that despite the fact that this was not directed by Zemeckis, it was kind of a necessary part of the story. It's part of that kind of trilogy of good but odd commercial failures that sort of teed up the transition into the Romancing the Stone and Back to the Future Bob Zemeckis. So, and I'm really glad we watched it. It's just one of those weird blind spots where it's like everyone has always shit on 1941 so hard that even in spite of the fact that I have grown up obsessed with Spielberg, I did watch a lot on TV once when I was a kid, and that was about it. But I just have I'm glad I've revisited it though, because it's a weird one.
It's same as Rocky V, which I still haven't seen, unfortunately. In the whole Spielberg repertoire there, just you always heard, well, it's the bad one. So just, had never seen it for whatever reason and just saw it for the first time just a couple of days ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what'd you think, Cliff? First time for you?
Ooh, well, I almost can't see it as a movie. My brain is trying to piece together what I'm looking at, what's not working, what is working, what different elements are going on at the same time that are blowing my mind. I almost don't know where to start.
Well, it definitely feels like something that was cut down. That's the other thing, is it feels like a film that was like that. The extent to which I feel like it's one of those things where you feel the initial breath of this big, big, big epic, and yet you feel these big epic sequences like John Belushi being introduced, landing a plane at a gas station, and yet on a sequence by sequence, scene by scene, moment by moment level, everything feels just a little bit compressed and a little bit cut up and a little bit chopped down. I'm very curious. It's difficult to watch the film without processing it on that level. Exactly. But Richard, what about you?
Yeah, it's like you said. It's weird. There are parts that work really well, and just reading a bit about it being made and the reactions at the time. It was supposed to be 2.5 hours, has a half hour ripped out. Apparently it was supposed to be way darker. Zemeckis and Gale wrote a very black satire, and Spielberg came in and wanted to do something not quite that. And so the tone was made brighter, and then apparently, just some stuff I read. It's time for that time. But all the actors that came in were seeing Belushi and Dan Aykroyd going to 11 all the time, and everybody else decided that they were going to go up to 11 too. And Spielberg has said, like, I didn't know how to control them at this time. Everybody saw the 11 performance, wanted to give the 11 performance, which I think you can definitely tell in the film.
Yeah. Well, it's the 11 performance. It's the 11 everything because the film is so chopped up, because it doesn't quite hold together as a movie. That's why all of its just crazy out there elements just stand out so much. You know, the crazy production values that go on in that, that end sequence, the planes flying through the fact that we have our enemy submarine is piloted by Toshiro Mifune and Christopher Lee. the fact that everything is just so big and so weird, and it just doesn't gel together or cohere together into anything that quite makes sense. Mm-hmm. It's like
there's definitely an embarrassment of riches in the film, like just huge production values, huge, like just tons and tons of money, tons and tons of famous faces, so you kind of see, you know, Spielberg was famous, you know, for kind of you know, he's associated with that whole idea of filmmaking being like a train set and wanting to crash his train set. And that is exactly what this film kind of felt like. It felt like Spielberg getting a bunch of planes and a bunch of trains and a bunch of shit that he could blow up. And that way, in that way, it felt very similar to film like Brothers, you know, a film like you know, those big kind of crazy action comedies from the 70s where they crash a million cars, and you feel that kind of vibe throughout the whole movie, where, you know, you have like the whole cast of Animal House is there, and like the whole cast of I Want to Hold Your Hand is there, and so it's just like Spielberg was like seeing what people around him, his friends John Landis and his friends Zemeckis, were doing. He's like, I want to do one, so he grabbed up all them actors and it's
just a big blender of a movie. It's just a big made up movie of all the things blended together.
Well, that's part of the reason that it feels like it feels actually much more a part of Spielberg's filmography watching it now than I think I probably would have if I had encountered it when I was much younger. But it's interesting because it was before even Spielberg had defined in his own mind what a Spielberg film was. So he was like, why can't I have my own Blues Brothers Animal House sort of mixed up crazy Looney Tunes thing? Because obviously he's working with Bob Zemeckis and Bob Gale over on the I Wanna Hold Your Hand, which has so much like Warner Brothers, like explicitly like Warner Brothers cartoon elements in it. And so it seems like a natural fit. Like, I get these guys, I'll make a Warner Brothers cartoon movie, but it'll be set in something in an adjacent era during World War II. You know, it'll be it'll all work and it'll all gel and it'll all be perfect. And it's interesting because it feels in that way like a prologue to, and Cliff and I were kind of talking about this, it feels like this interesting prologue to something he would later nail with Raiders of the Lost Ark.
His very next movie.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing, is like it feels like he will nail with just that, where there's this kind of clumsy integration of like of some of the Chuck Jones elements, and that it's, you see it all kind of wrapped up and perfected just one movie later, and it's sort of this like this testing ground for so many things that he'll nail tonally.
I was watching some of the stuff on it, and he said that the drubbing that 1941 took was the best thing that could have ever happened to him. Mm-hmm. He sobered up so quickly because when he went into this, he thought he was Teflon, like everything was going to work. Mm-hmm. He went way over budget, was adding a bunch of stuff. He added a lot of Belushi stuff. Mm. The whole tank through a paint factory was something that he just came up with.
He's not added out of nowhere. Yeah.
Yeah. There's like, so, and like we're saying, everything is huge and big, and there's so many explosions and so many storylines. And he said, like, yeah, this was the lesson that he needed. Raiders, he was shooting as this was kind of rolling out. So he said that the fact that he had Raiders on the plate was what saved him from, like, depression spiraling from 1941 being a failure. And he also said that Indiana Jones was the most prepared he's ever been for to direct a movie, which makes sense when you consider what happened with this one.
Absolutely, because in so many ways it is so similar. I mean, so much of the look of the 1940s and a lot of the Looney Tunes humor is all in 1941, but it's just figuring out, okay, how campy to play the characters, how broad, how earnest to make it.
Because some of the only differences are tonal in some of those things. Some of the gags are even repeated, like famously, like the
the chain gag that the Nazi guy uses before he interrogates Karen Allen in Raiders of the Lost Ark, the clotheshanger gag, is was one that Christopher Lee did in 1941 that was cut out of the film. And there's actually a scene where he's standing in the doorway and you can actually see him still holding the little chain thing, which you literally see the same gag in both films. But what's fantastic about Raiders is that Raiders plays that goofiness off of a higher stake, more serious adventure tone that the audience can kind of invest in, that these little moments kind of brighten up the tone as it goes through. Whereas, you know, 1941 just kind of feels a little bit like a hat on a hat on a hat, you know,
yeah.
With just, anyway, continue.
Well, you just can't really take any of the characters seriously, basically.
Yes.
So, which is fine. In Airplane, I suppose, but it just doesn't quite work with everything that's going on here.
Yes, Airplane being another one, you know, to think about, you know, again, before really it had been fully defined or had been more defined what a Spielberg film was. Spielberg had a little bit of Airplane, he had a little bit of Animal House, he had a little bit of I Won't Hold Your Hand, you know. He even had, we noticed, he replicates the fantastic, the big push-in shot on in Texas Chainsaw Massacre when it pushes in on a plane right as Nancy Allen is walking up to a plane and has this low slung angle under her butt looking up at the big plane as she's walking up. So he was just absorbing everything from that period and taking it all in and regurgitating it all into this film. So it was a great purging, this 1941.
Yeah, thank goodness. Gave us Indiana Jones. Zemeckis made Spielberg's career. There it is. Without this incredibly high profile prop.
That's plot, right.
What we've had.
All right, Richard. So tell us this idea that came apparently from John Milius. What was this idea? What is 1941 about this movie?
I think they just wanted to do Milius wanted to do a film based on the L.A. air raid, I think, and pitched it as this black comedy, and then had the two jokers that could go write it for him that he thought was funny. And then
and by black
so
comedy, do you mean
a real based on real events like the citizens of L.A.? Somebody had a gun out and thought they saw a plane, and just started firing into the sky, and so everybody in L.A. started firing into the sky with. No plane. So that's apparently a real thing. I did no research on that front, but that was one thing they referenced. Apparently a Japanese sub was seen off the coast of Maine, I think, after Pearl Harbor, which is another key piece they pulled. And then they pulled from some of the Zoot Suit riots, where you had the dancers and the sailors and Marines all in a big fight. So they kind of took those real things, a lot like they did with Beatlemania and the Ed Sullivan Show, and then crammed a whole bunch of explosions and stunts and silliness and, you know, dick jokes and scissoring jokes all in around the thing, as was that was what they do.
So I have to imagine that the black
that was
to imagine...
I don't know more about Milius having the idea, but I guarantee you they were shooting Skeet at the at the time. Apparently they were doing that a lot with Milius.
So that's what we know. We know famously that Spielberg and John Milius and Robert Zemeckis would go shooting shotguns together, the three of them, which is a fun image. Which is a fun image to think about. But I have to imagine if they were doing a black comedy version of the thing, it would be like what? Like a more of a Doctor Strangelove style comedy, more of a, you know, explicitly taking on the horrors of war.
Exactly. Because Milius, think of Milius directing this. Mm-hmm. If that were to be a Milius directing project, that's how it would have to be. Because I cannot see any chance of John Milius directing this screenplay or doing these kinds of gags. That's just not in his DNA, and I know because I share a lot of that DNA.
And one of the interesting quotes, we've talked about this on the other episodes, Kyle, but there's a quote from Milius talking about 41, said, the three of us formed a group, that was Zemeckis, Gale, and him. Our motto was Civilis sine prudentia, a citizenry without prudence, which basically means social irresponsibility. So that's where that came from. Direct quote from Milius about 1941 makes perfect sense. And just thinking about some more backstory on the general that got cast. They originally, Spielberg himself went and tried to get both John Wayne and Charlton Heston for that, the role of the general, thinking it would be great and American and funny. And both of them turned him down flat and was like, don't make this movie. This is completely unpatriotic. This is terrible. You're shitting over all the sacrifice. And then
that makes sense for both of those guys.
But you can, I think kind of you see where some of the pressure from Spielberg, which took it out of this Dr. Strangelove zone, just within that small story.
Yeah, you can kind of see that there was one script for one version of the movie. He saw that, you know, as Spielberg was a force of nature and had a ton of, I'm sure, had the ability to do whatever he wanted at the time. So he uses it as a vehicle to make kind of a different kind of a movie, a lighter film, something that, like we were saying, has a lot of connective tissue between films like Animal House and Blues Brothers and even I Want to Hold Your Hand. And my God, the entire cast of I Want to Hold Your Hand is in this movie. I mean, that's why we had to watch this film. I'm glad we did. That's why we had to fucking watch this as part of this podcast, because I mean, what, like Nancy Allen, fucking Eddie Deason is in this movie. Others that
Bobby
I can't
DiCicco.
Remember.
Yes. What's her name?
Mary Jo Sperber.
Mary Jo Sperber. Yep. Mm-hmm. They're all there.
They're all there. Yes, you have to wonder. Some little twist of fate, you know. Spielberg, clearly, he's making I Want to Hold Your Hand with all these people, hanging out with them, having a grand old time, bunch of young people, successful in Hollywood. He produces that movie. He brings all of his friends along, literally like all of them, to go make this fucking movie. And you wonder, you know, if Spielberg had, if those films had been hits, what is the alternate trajectory for Spielberg in this? Would if he had just gone on making some more goofy movies with just like fucking Eddie Deason, would Eddie Deason be a much bigger movie star? Man. Probably.
If I the mean, movie did well, yeah. And I think just getting on to the kind of Spielberg thing and tracking it back a little bit to Zemeckis, is that was a quote Spielberg has said, like, Zemeckis should have been the director for it. He's convinced that he would have done a better job, and that was it's the kind of movie that the author needed to step forward and make and direct, which makes some sense given we've seen Used Cars and I Want to Hold Your Hand now, and knowing that they had something much, much darker. But they did say that, like, we're talking about a 2.5 hour epic war comedy that only Spielberg had the pull in Hollywood to do at the time, coming off of Jaws and Close Encounters.
So here's some, since this is Bob Zemeckis is not a butthead, here's a fun game. How would this film have been different if Bob Zemeckis directed it? I'll lead us off. There's a definite absence of really dangerous looking stunts in this film. And if Bob Zemeckis had directed this film, can you imagine the dangerous plane, car, and tank stunts that we would have seen in this goddamn movie?
There's
so many close calls.
The tank stuff, I wrote down, is great.
It would have been so dangerous, though. We could have had a John Landis situation. We could have had a situation where Bob Zemeckis never directed Back to the Future or did anything like that, because, you know,
With tanks and planes, that's entirely possible.
That's true.
I did make a note. There is one stunt that I absolutely love in the movie, and it's when the general is outside and has walked out into the chaos of the fighting and the army guys like driving in, and he turns, and it's a three shot, and he turns and he goes, "What a goddamn mess!" As a car is like flipping in the background of the shot, crashing in the back. It's like, okay, that is a glorious
airplane gag. That is a Zucker gag that Zucker never did. That is just wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yes, I think you're right. They did, but the fact that they have a tank, and it was the paint thing wasn't in the original script apparently. But thinking about that as a Zemeckis gag is because there were guys in that building as the paint was being charged through by that tank.
Goddamn right.
It actually reminded me, I just watched on your recommendation, Kyle, The Great Race.
Yes.
With the whole pie sequence that is exactly the that yep. thing.
What's this? Like, that's a film. The Great Race is just one of those films that just settles in to, you know, to a set piece every few minutes where it's like, and here's the pie fight sequence. Settle in, everybody. You're going to be here for a couple minutes. And here's the cowboy fight sequence. And no, that's a great one. And yeah, very, there's a lot of connective tissue between visiting Blake Edwards and this, but yeah, so rad.
It just reminded me when I saw that, because one of the things Spielberg said on the I Want to Hold Your Hand special features is one of the things he loved about the script that they wrote is he was like, you guys like destroyed every set in the movie. So we would shoot and then mm-hmm. every set would just get destroyed. Yeah, the street getting yes. destroyed, the dance club gets destroyed, the airfield gets destroyed, the mm-hmm. just the house is like literally pulled mm-hmm. into the ocean.
Yes. The whole thing is about destroying that house. Basically, it's the slow erosion of that house over the course yeah. and that property, that poor family over the course of the movie.
Yes. So what clearly does remain are some fantastic ideas from what is the script from Bob Zemeckis' script, like just that fantastic thread of Ned Beatty's house, just this focal point around which the whole movie turns, that first picked out just randomly to be a strategic defense point where they're going to put a giant machine gun in his front yard to defend against enemy planes, and then he's got fucking kids on it and his daughters are dating and all that shit, and then how it all circles back around to the point where Ned Beatty eventually has to take on the gun and use it to defend his house from Toshiro Mifune and a Japanese submarine. And just those three, that little thread there kind of tells you the whole story of 1941. And then that goddamn thing at the end, the culmination when they push the house quite very really into the ocean where it crashes down, that was fucking rad. So
you got one take on something like that.
Yeah, that is true.
They mm-hmm. they got it. So yeah,
I think just think about that beachfront property in Malibu. It's like a modest blue collar family in 1941 can yep. have a Malibu beach home that's just yep. lovely. How much would that be worth today? Mm-hmm. Simpler times. It should be like that, man.
Back then, you could just push that shit into the ocean. You're like, I don't even like this house anymore. You just push that shit. They did it in the movie. You saw it.
It was a real house, apparently. Did you see it?
I saw it.
It was a house.
I noticed it was a house when it broke apart into all the parts of a house on the beach.
And fell into the ocean.
Speaking, by the way, of Spielberg just sucking up fucking everything from that period, the fact that there the John Belushi at the end in the fighter planes just doing the Star Wars trench run, which just yeah. Throwing one of them son of a bitches in there. It's like Spielberg just literally got to do one of everything that was popular or cool or hip at that time.
I mean, seriously, of all the cool Spielberg action sequences that have been done in movies, that's got to be, you know, the biggest and highest production value one, or very close to it.
Oh, I don't know.
This silly movie.
I don't know. I mean, it's like it definitely has scope, and the miniatures, and the miniatures feel miniature a little bit, but it's a fantastic.
Well, it felt feel very Terry Gilliam, honestly, even before yes. Terry Gilliam was doing his. Well, was Terry Gilliam doing any of his miniature stuff by 19?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yes, I feel the same way. And just that, I don't know. It feels like this interesting nexus point, because when you look at the full breadth of their filmographies, you think of there being a lot of difference between Spielberg and, you know, the Zuckers and fucking John Landis. But this just feels like this interesting junction point where they were all part of the same zeitgeist and all trying to do. And Robert Zemeckis, obviously, with all the Looney Tunes that's in this. And it's just interesting to see all of that. And then it just gives you a new perspective on, like, then revisiting, you know, how effortlessly all of those great Looney Tunes gags are, like, woven into Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's like, my God, Spielberg was touched by God. How was he able to do this? And then you look back, you're like, oh, he was able to experiment with a very, very, very big,
the
fucking,
largest experiment, largest yeah. cinematic experiment yeah. ever mm-hmm. been granted.
Yep, yep, yep.
And the smartest set of collaborators you could have around with you.
Mm-hmm. Did you? He actually said he's proudest of Spielberg's proudest of the dance sequence, and apparently considered making the entire thing a musical once he saw how well that performed, and has since kicked himself, saying that he just wishes he had the guts to make it a musical.
That would have made it better. That would have improved it. That would have been the key to have made the whole goddamn thing work, I think.
Just to give a sense where his head was at. It seems like he's throwing everything he's got at it, but is not sure how to fit all the different pieces together. And there's some wide shot comedy stuff where I had to like pause it and be like, oh, this is the joke. It's right here, as opposed to it just hitting my eyeballs is funny. Mm-hmm. Namely, like, I think it's the Japanese soldier in the sub, like holding the gun straight up into his eye.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, speaking of things that were very, 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 very Zemeckisian, yeah, I just love the idea that really the thing that maybe, I'm curious how this film would play if it didn't open with the Jaws sequence, Spielberg revisiting Jaws, the girl being hoisted up onto the submarine, the guy popping out, that fantastic shot of her butt. It's simultaneously Spielberg indulging in the naughty boyishness of Zemeckis. He's willing to dabble in that pool. It's like he's decided to walk around the back of the school and like have a cigarette, you know, like just
he's
test
trying
it out.
Really hard to smoke drugs.
He's trying hard to smoke the drugs, you know. And but at the same time, it's look because he's also, you know, he is satirizing one of his own sequences, which in itself, given
from only
the full
two
context,
movies ago.
only two movies ago, but in the full breadth of how indulgent the rest of the film feels, it makes that opening sequence kind of feel like he's really sucking his own dick and just celebrating his enormous success. And so when you kind of pair that with like the girl and the guy's like Hollywood!
And
their butts dripping, you can imagine why some people engaged with the thing a bit critically just from the get-go. Guys, we have to pause real quick. I forgot to plug my computer in before we started, and I'm about to run out of batteries. I'm sorry, I'll be right back.
You're good.
Cliff, you're in this room.
And I'm back.
So to just touch on where you were at, I think the Jaws thing was Spielberg's idea to include that in the movie. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about the first test screening that they did. And apparently when the Jaws thing played, everybody was like, as Zemeckis always says, on the ceiling. It was testing, that moment tested really well. And he said, I was sitting there and I was like, I did it. I've got a comedy hit on my hands. And then he was like, and then there were four laughs over the next 2 hours. And everybody was just, half of the audience was just holding their ears for most of the movie.
Oh.
So talk about learning some lessons. Yes. It's a bad test screening. Apparently, his buddy Sid Sheinberg, who was one of the heads of the studio and very, very kind to him, came up afterwards and said, there's a movie in this mess. We just got to go find it. And then I think it lost 30 minutes. And
that was before the loss of 30 minutes.
I believe so. It almost had to be, because he fought for those 30 minutes, but apparently didn't have final cut. And the studio was like, we can't have 2.5 hours of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would be very curious to visit that cut of the film and see a little bit more, because you see all these you see fun ideas. You see John Belushi landing. You see the Dan Aykroyd visiting Ned Beatty's house to drop off the machine gun, but it's all just blasting by you so fucking fast. It just feels like there's very little to hang on to, and so it's one of those. The thing about it that feels uniquely un-Spielbergian is that when you get to those moments later on, you start to get deep into the film, you get to bigger moments later on. It doesn't feel like there have been any characters for you to hang on to. You kind of still don't know who anyone is beyond, like, you know, you kind of have a good sense of who Nancy Allen is, what her deal is, but you're just visiting those characters so infrequently that it's just hard to hang on to anything. And so there's just big breath space time where you just sort of begin to lose touch, and it just becomes explosions and gunfire.
Let's talk about the whole Nancy Allen storyline, because that was definitely my favorite thing.
Yes.
Her one trait is she can only have sex in an airborne plane. Yep. She loves
horny
airplanes.
For planes.
And that's Spielberg doing his Cronenbergian thing before Cronenberg. It's years before Crash. She had something, sexy woman who was really into chrome and grease and combustion engines.
The funny thing is, to talk about things that are just, again, Spielberg's just absorbing everything, it's literally just a reprisal of Nancy Allen's role in I Want to Hold Your Hand, except instead of wanting to fuck a bass guitar, she wants to fuck a plane.
Yeah.
Get the one who wants to fuck inanimate objects. But I just like that's just the only thing that serves is just the conundrum that Flyboy has to solve, which is just, how do I get into a plane and get it into the air, committing treason, just fucking risking lives and millions of dollars of property and potentially, you know, accelerating the war just so I can get off with Nancy Allen in a plane. But then you remember that it is Nancy Allen, and she was very, very hot back then, and so it does track and it makes sense.
I just love that shot when it cuts to him and she's trying to get it on, and he's just like white knuckling the steering wheel, being like, "Oh gosh, okay, we're up in the air." He's like, "Oh, but you're not up."
Stress. You can't get it up.
Yeah, it's about his. Dong. It was about his dong.
Mm-hmm. It was about the dong.
And seeing how sexy Nancy Allen is here and in other movies, in Blowout, just does make me sad that the role she's best known for is the totally asexual Lois, partner Lois in RoboCop. Mm-hmm. Asexual, yes. Maybe lesbian.
It depends. For us, that is certainly the case, but she's pretty sexy and Blowout, she's pretty sexy. Oh, yeah. I don't want to hold your hand. She had a lot of time right up there, right at the forefront, before she chopped it all off to become a cop, a kick-ass cop in a kick-ass movie.
She was kind of a mess, though.
That's a line from the movie. Murphy, I'm a mess.
Nailed it. Nailed it.
Man, we did it.
We did it. So Zemeckis, that was clearly Zemeckis writing the Nancy Allen sequence. That tracks 100%. The other thing I really loved, Dan Aykroyd has that speech standing on the tank in the middle of the thing. And like, it feels like to me when I was watching, it was like Dan Aykroyd seems to be the one actor in the movie that like was on the level. He seemed to know what the movie was supposed to be or what it originally was. Mm-hmm. Like the way he delivers those lines, I'm like, that is what the movie could have been. When we have Dan Aykroyd giving the big patriotic speech, or even him at the beginning when he's demonstrating how to use the gun and offering, like giving him the privilege of having the big giant anti-aircraft submarine gun in his yard. Like that was like, I could feel the movie being a better thing in those sequences.
Yeah, and it's also fun. You get Spielberg fully indulging in Dan Aykroyd's jargon abilities, his abilities to talk about lots of technical jargon, which we would later see again in Ghostbusters. And also, it's one of those obvious things. Like it's like you know intellectually that you know that Dan Aykroyd is in 1941, but seeing it here again, and then seeing him show up in Raiders, he has a small part in Raiders where he, you know, leads Indiana Jones to the plane, or is it
Temple of Doom?
Above Doom. I'm sorry. Yeah, that didn't sound right as I was saying it. But it's just, again, it makes this feel so much more connected. Suddenly that little moment is imbued with just a tremendous amount more history and life for me having seen this movie than where it would have been a fun and knowing cameo as opposed to, you know, when I was a kid, it was like, oh, Ray Dan from Ghostbusters.
Yeah, why is Dan Aykroyd in this movie? Exactly. Which was always my thing. It was like, wait, is that Dan Aykroyd? It is, yes. Dan Aykroyd. Why is Dan Aykroyd there? Like, we can't even see his face, really.
Exactly.
This answers that a bit.
This, it does. It does.
Dan, come talk fast in front of this plane. You've done that before, kind of.
Exactly. He knows that he's not scared of propellers. It's important. There's a lot of propellers, and as Raiders of the Lost Raiders of the Lost taught us, propellers can be very, very dangerous, because that one guy got caught in one. He was really killed, and they left the footage in, Richard. They left the footage in.
It's amazing that he got away with that and Landis didn't.
I was wondering if you were going to... Because I unknowingly set you up for that.
No director's jail for killing stuntmen.
No.
Just talent and children.
That's exactly right. Oof, harsh.
So, yeah, it's harsh. I for whatever reason, like after watching 1941, I went back and I watched some videos on the Twilight Zone thing. I was just like, what happened? Because Spielberg was producer on that too, right? And so...
Yeah. Well, Shudder just did a whole episode on that, on their Cursed Films series. They did like a 30-minute documentary about that like last week. Sad.
Yeah,
that's what that's what happens when those crazy risky stunts wrong, unfortunately. So, and now we know that, Richard.
Thank goodness. But
that did not happen in 1941. Thank God.
No, there were just tanks rolling over cars. I love the fact that the tank rolls over like four cars. It's just a pleasure to see that kind of that specific kind of destruction.
Yeah, well, I mean, just the idea of, okay, you know, what if the Pacific, what if the West Coast had become a battleground in the Pacific theater of the war, and there were planes flying over Hollywood and all that shit? That is a fantastic set piece. It's just fantastic. Just you know, many set pieces to indulge in. And you can see why just the allure of that alone made Spielberg just say, fuck it. Like, that alone, that's the movie. That'll hold up the whole goddamn film. And then I can just indulge. And I'll cast all the funny people with all the great personality that I know will just give, you know, that he's just seen in several other films, you know, just hold the whole film up with their personality. And it's that thing where you just think, well, if I can just throw maximum effort at this concept, it will be a movie. And he learned that maybe wasn't 100% true, though. I still enjoy, I mean, clearly it was a failure at the time, but I still enjoy quite a bit of 1941.
Well, actually, maybe we're to the edge of exploring why doesn't it work exactly? You say all of these things, and I'm trying to catalog all the things that it has going on with it. Now, assuming even that the longer cuts, the audience didn't react to it, so the longer cut really didn't work either. You know, what is wrong exactly?
Well, one of the things, and this might sound strange to say, but it was something I began to feel, because you can sense, especially having come right off of watching I Want to Hold Your Hand, coming right off of watching Used Cars, I think that there is, I never would have thought of it this way before, but there's a kind of extemporaneous chaos to Spielberg's style, to how his dialogue scenes are handled, especially when he has a lot of actors in frame at one time. He's almost, compared to Zemeckis, compared to the a little bit more, compared to the kind of more almost like an animator's precision that we would see in Zemeckis, where he would execute on his kind of Looney Tunes gags, Spielberg feels at moments almost, this is going to sound weird, but almost Altman-esque. And so there's this weird thing where you have this goofy, goofy tone, but you have an almost chaotic imprecision that just doesn't quite jive. And you see an absence of that chaotic imprecision in his very next film. In Raiders of the Lost Ark, you see like that, you see a much more kind of laser focused and buttoned up Spielberg. But I think that loosey goosiness means that which then led to bloat, which then got cut out when the thing became shorter. again, leads to a lot of things that in concept feel like they should be transporting Spielberg sequences, like John Belushi has a fucking World War II dogfight over Hollywood, two people like go up in a plane and to have sex, they're being shot down, or to Shiro Mifune and Christopher Lee are in a submarine together. These all things, they sound great in concept, and yet the moments themselves fall very, very, very flat. And so, I don't know, it's just, I think that you can feel an imprecision deriving from just the indulgence and the chaos and the all of that. So and that's how what I think, man.
I think I kind of had a similar thought, just with when we are introduced to Bobby DiCicco and his buddy in the kitchen, like we mm-hmm. start to see them dancing and they're working in tandem. And then it's like, oh, this is a great sequence. And it's still funny, but it gets so choppy in there where it's just like cut, 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 cut.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And
oh yeah, like, that sequence is basically incoherent. It's like, and right. Especially it does not actually favor 1941. And this is a little, in praise of Bob Zemeckis, it does not favor 1941 to see the exact same cast executing on a very similar script, having just seen I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Right.
Because think about how kind of interested, invested, and attached, relatively speaking, you were to that exact same group of people 15 minutes into I Want to Hold Your Hand, whereas like you're half an hour into this fucking movie, and it's not so much that I'm not enjoying the individual moments, I am actually, but there's very little sense of any characters that you're reminded of that you actually can kind of hook into, or any sort of grounded world for all of this insanity to play off of, which is again something that you would see just one movie later in Raiders of the Lost Ark, a very very, very grounded world, as you know, kind of fantastic and effervescent as it is, a very, very grounded world for all of these delightful little gags to then bounce off of. So I don't know, blah. You get it?
Yeah, I get mm-hmm. it. You get it. And it to return to your question, Cliff, about what isn't quite working, and I think for me, I see like the script. What they have feels like it's that they're trying to do Dr. Strangelove very much. And it's like almost Spielberg didn't have the confidence to play it straight in that mm-hmm. style and that tone with like yep. the muted performances. Because if you take some mm-hmm. of the performances and just mute them,
yeah.
Suddenly it's
well, then,
like,
then you're halfway to Raiders of the Lost Ark if you do that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. And like, and what the way Zemeckis and Gale have said they write, it's like there's no jokes. Like the characters mm-hmm. are saying things, and it's our perspective on the thing that is funny. Us seeing them do the thing is funny from our perspective. It's not that they're mm-hmm. trying to make a joke. And so I think if you take the movie and just like ease it down mm-hmm. a little bit, and the actors are not in on the joke, they mm-hmm. are playing to character, that may help with the character thing. That probably helps with the yeah. jokes.
Yep. I don't know, is John Belushi capable of that? I think he was. Well, yeah, he was yeah. one serious movie.
No, he was capable, but I think the question then becomes, is it, again, when all that stuff was just one hip cultural jumble, your Animal Houses and all yeah. that kind of shit, it's like you cast John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd in your movie, it seems like a great idea, but that, it sounds like, sets a tone that is irreconcilable with performance-wise with the rest of the script. Because yeah, I mean, moments like the barn sequence with like Treat Williams and the blonde chick and fucking Chico falling out of the barn and all of that, you can see that there's a charming Back to the Future kind of moment in that. And again, you see like the second, you know, poisonous bully character from Zemeckis, a sort of the second time you Treat Williams is kind of his the next proto Biff that we see as we're getting closer and closer to eventually getting to Biff in Back to the Future. But you can see those moments there. But then what betrays them is that everyone's screaming the whole time. Everyone's screaming and everything's fast and everything's a bit too much like a television commercial, like a bit like a cartoon, less like a Spielberg movie, etc. Did you guys feel this?
The screaming? Yes, 100%. I think it's funny. Go ahead.
No, I'm trying to contemplate the television commercial thing. It's sort of, I sort of vibe on that. The television commercial where a television commercial of something set in the 1940s with that just seems to fit the vibe. Anyway, that image seems to fit the performance.
They're all basically Mentos ads. Exactly. Each sequence is a series of Mentos ads.
Except selling Coca-Cola that still had cocaine in it.
Correct. Mm-hmm. But even with like it, just to go back to the performance thing, is if everybody is muted except for Belushi, and I don't necessarily think I would change Dan Aykroyd's performance, even if the rest of the movie changed, because I think Aykroyd's tone of the thing is perfect. You have this like muted thing, and then all of a sudden you cut to the Belushi character who's just hoo-hawing and setting gas stations on fire and throwing Coke bottles out the window, and then suddenly mm-hmm. that's the Slim Pickens-y stuff in Doctor Strangelove, or more specifically the Doctor Strangelove in Doctor Strangelove, right?
Yes. And no, he absolutely is the Slim Pickens. But then you have Slim Pickens in the actual goddamn movie.
Yes, just you do.
For some extra fucking scenes.
Slim Pickens in that movie. A lot more Slim Pickens than you were expecting to see in that movie. All of them.
And you drop Richard. If I were to pick a part that was Richard's favorite part, it would be when Slim Pickens is making pooping sounds and dropping boots into a toilet. Was I right, Richard?
It's like top three. I did like when you learn that's why he's gotten them out, and he's like, it's like a Blazing Saddles. It becomes Blazing Saddles at that moment.
Yep.
Just
I lost track of his plan there, but yes, it did result in him making pooping noises and beating people up while in his underwear, which
he had to. He had to get the room clear so he could hide above the door.
When they came in, he
can fall on them and beat them up because he's an American, damn it.
There we go.
It's pooping is distraction, which is the best the best kind of distraction.
Yep.
Apparently the role was given much more, he was given much more to do when he was cast. Apparently that was not a whole sequence that was written. Apparently they got him, added a bunch of his character stuff because they got Slim Pickens. And so you start to see how this movie grew out of control.
How it blew up and kept indulging itself and indulging itself.
They kept adding Belushi stuff. They kept adding Slim Pickens stuff.
Well, that's exactly the thing. It's like you already have John Belushi playing kind of the Slim Pickens-y character for this movie, but then you also get Slim Pickens. It's like, let's add another one. You'll just have two going at the same time. You'll have both guys.
And then everybody will see everybody doing the Slim Pickens thing, and then everybody wants to be Slim Pickens.
Yes.
And there's that great his name is of course Hollis Wood in the movie, and so the Japanese guys in the submarine are like, Hollywood, and he's like, that's me. That's a Brian De Palma joke.
Yes,
it's a Brian De Palma joke, is that what you said?
Yeah, De Palma wrote that for that thing, because he's married to Nancy Allen. He was on set. He's friends with Spielberg, and he was like, you should have him do the who's on first gag with the Hollywood thing.
That's great. I love that.
So De Palma is also responsible for what this became.
Yeah, I find myself he's responsible in that he married Nancy Allen, so he won. He won.
Maybe Slim Pickens is in this movie to be the John Milius analog, because if anyone embodies the John Milius attitude, I think it is Slim Pickens. Pickens there fighting his way out of that submarine.
That's right.
Seems like this is the Red Dawn fantasy before Red Dawn he gets to enact it.
While one could very clearly see this the Zemeckis version of this movie, I could not very clearly picture the Milius version of this movie. I mean, not to say that the subject matter is not Milius. I mean, honestly, the subject matter is basically Red Dawn, you know, several years before Red Dawn, just set in a different era, you know. So I guess in that way, with the Milius version of this concept, like when he hires this young Bob Gale to write this screenplay off of his, is he expecting more of a Red Dawn type of a situation, or would we have seen something a little bit more, you know, Judge Roy Bean-ish out of him? Thoughts?
They brought Milius the script, and apparently Milius loved it and was talking it up to Spielberg while they were shooting Guns. And he's like, I got this. These two guys wrote this great, hilarious thing, and it's this big, silly war picture, and everything blows up. And Spielberg's like, I gotta read that. You gotta send it to me. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, apparently Milius was digging Well, it's hard because you have to separate the screenplay from what the movie actually is. But you can see the elements of something that I don't know Milius that well. But you can, I think, just extrapolating like what the tone of Who Framed Roger Rabbit into this. like that, I kind of have a picture of what the Zemeckis version is. But I don't know what a Milius version feels like. Yeah. But apparently he thought it was hysterical.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Milius, the Milius version is, yeah, Milius really done a comedy that I can think of at all. So it's like this would be a big departure for Milius to try to do, I guess, a dark Doctor Strangelove version of this here.
Well, as a director, maybe not something of that precise tone, but there's obviously a tremendous amount of humor in all of his scripts. So it makes sense. But it would have been a different Milius trajectory to have a Milius career where he directed a film like this. And that's, again, yeah, one of those cool things seeing these films is that it's easy to see a direct line between, you know, fucking Jaws and, you know, Jurassic Park than to take a look at 1941 and kind of see that moment when Spielberg didn't know how much, you know, how much Zucker and how much Zemeckis and how much Landis and how much other things he was going to be. He was playing with everything at that moment. And that's what's kind of cool about it is, you know, what would a John Milius 1941 have done to sort of augment the trajectory of John Milius's career? A little bit more silliness, et cetera, and war.
I totally forgot about this. One of the things I watched was an early trailer for 1941, which was written and directed by John Milius.
Oh shit!
Yeah, and
okay,
it is
a piece of the puzzle.
It is not what it's not selling what it ultimately was. It's all John Belushi landing in a plane, spitting coke, and delivering this monologue to camera, very Uncle Sam style, about what's going to happen when the Japanese invade and the street signs are going to be in Japanese.
I feel like I really, 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 yeah, really need to see that now.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll send you guys a link. But yeah, so I mean, you get a sense of what that is, and that feels like Stripe C to me.
Yeah.
But yeah, to extrapolate that into the whole rest of the movie is my brain can't handle.
Yeah, again, the promise of the film is a fantastic one. The promise of the film and what it could, all of those, you could see all of those elements just gelling and synergizing really, really, really well. And maybe that's just it. It's like if the tone had been just, you know, if the tone and the performance had been slightly reined in, but we needed that. We needed Spielberg to go through this experience to eventually get to Raiders. So there you go. And we needed this so that Bob Zemeckis could eventually get to Back to the Future.
Correct. Which he did. And Romancing the Stone. This led to...
This led to Romancing the Stone, being
which has its own
another
thing.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, yeah.
There was one thing I wanted to talk to you guys about because you're huge Kubrick fans. And like watching this, my thought was, oh, did Spielberg not have the guts to just try and make this a Doctor Strangelove? And that's why he leaned into Screwball and he leaned into the musical idea really hard. Mm-hmm. And I only ask that because if you look at Spielberg's career, he did AI, which is him making a Kubrick movie. And he also did Ready Player One, where he is aping The Shining. So there's something in there. And I wonder if it was just too early or it was a scary thing or what?
What precisely are you asking, Richard?
I don't know. I felt like he was given this thing that's written like a Doctor Strangelove, and it's like on a plate for him. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I thought that there's a part of me that says he wasn't ready to try and tackle a Kubrick thing yet.
I think that is. Well, I think that that's that kind of. That is definitely true. I mean, obviously, he had a great they had a great deal of adoration and a good relationship with Kubrick, but and they would tackle a bunch of stuff later on. But I think that the fact that we hadn't even gotten to we're like eight steps away from that. We're to heady and conceptual Spielberg. We're quite a ways away from that. We're still at that Spielberg can't. He's still trying to nail down Raiders of the Lost Ark at this point. So I think it's potentially a wise decision for Spielberg not to have tried to tackle, to have it's not so much that I think that something was beyond his capacity, but clearly, like, what he was after tonally, where his heart was so in the other direction with his obsession with the, you know, produce. What did he produce? What was the first thing he produced? It was, I want to hold your hand. That's where his heart was. So right. It makes sense that his heart would be pulling him away from some sort of, you know, black political satire or something like that. It just wouldn't fucking fit. And maybe that really was the lesson, was making sure that the projects where he's investing his energy, the scripts where his energy actually fit with the type of energy he wants to put at them.
Well, remember that he was also at this time he was executive producing Used Cars. So I think his head was in that, like, darker.
But Used Cars is pretty satire thing. Goofy. I mean, Used Cars is a silly fucking movie.
It's a silly fucking thing that's very angry at America and American culture. Like, it's not pulling punches about it.
But there's a world of difference between between calling Used Cars somewhat of a black comedy in the sense that it's a little blue, and calling like Dr. Strangelove a black comedy because at the end world ends, you know. It's like they are vastly different things, and I would
consider
Used Cars to belong entirely to the world of light relative to, you know, Dr. Strangelove being a little bit of its darker cousin, its darker and more serious cousin. Maybe. God, did we just call Dr. Strangelove and Used Cars cousins? Yes, we did. That's the kind of quality film analysis you're going to get on Bob Zemeckis Is Not a Butthead.
They're cousins.
That's right. They're cousins. Dr. Strangelove and Used Cars.
And their second cousin, once removed, is being there. He's really quiet. He just sits in the corner, doesn't say much, but he's related somehow.
That's the Forrest Gump one. That's when we have to revisit for Forrest Gump.
There we go.
Another thing from on the Kubrick stuff, because they were friends at the time. Apparently, Kubrick told Spielberg, the movie's great, but it's not funny. Right. And was almost insisting on him, like, he's telling him, like, you should sell it as a drama. Don't sell it as a comedy.
Mm-hmm. Nope. That, well, there you go. I don't know if you could, I'm curious.
You could remove a couple of the broader John Belushi scenes, but I don't know that you can really, really retrofit it as a drama too well there.
I think perhaps you take out some of the Belushi stuff and the picking stuff like we were talking about, it's like suddenly the whole dancing sequence is a bit tighter. The storyline for those characters is a bit tighter because we're back with them. Maybe it starts to function as a drama instead of just a series of set pieces.
Perhaps.
I don't know.
The dance sequence is... Honestly, this is the fucked up part about talking about this movie, is it was a film that where so much happened, and yet I feel often at a loss to talk about it because there was so little to hang on to during it that, you know, it's like I remember the individual moments. I remember the dance sequence and all of these things, but I don't... It's like there are not characters that I, or arcs that I'm holding that I can draw on or hold to. I'm still just remembering a series of disconnected, fun and expensive looking moments, like a Ferris wheel rolling down a boardwalk, which was rad. Oh, and by the way,
there's a ventriloquist dummy.
Oh my god.
Yes. We didn't talk about worlds colliding. You have the mayor from Jaws and Eddie Deason from I Want to Hold Your Hand in a Ferris wheel together as characters for the whole movie. And I think that sums up what 1941 is, that was a fucking through line for the whole movie. The mayor from Jaws and Eddie Deason in a Ferris wheel.
With a ventriloquist dummy.
They spent a lot of time on that. Yeah.
That subplot worked 100%. Every part of that subplot worked.
Mm-hmm.
From that because all the way to the Ferris wheel rolling down the thingy.
I believed that he would be annoyed by Eddie Deason.
Yes. Highly plausible. Yes, exactly.
I love how the dummy is introduced. I think he screams at him, just shut your mouth. And then the dummy like raises into frame.
Yep.
And that feels like fits in a Dr. Strangelove tone that Zemeckis is making to me. Like that plays so.
Yeah, I mean, that feels very purely Warner Brothers, very purely Chuck Jones, very purely just Looney Tunes to me. And so again, I love, probably emboldened by the success, I'm sure, of films like Airplane and stuff, of course these guys are just shoving Looney Tunes into their goddamn movies, and I love
this
it.
This was pre-airplane.
Yes, this is true. That's true. I'm saying it. I'm realizing it.
Oh wow!
But you can see that that was just in the moment that everyone was doing that, and that they were trying to crack the code on that idea. And it just, anyway, it gives me just, that was the biggest takeaway, is it makes me so much more aware of what a vital thread that was in Raiders of the Lost Ark and in Spielberg style moving forward. And then by the time you get to, you know, Last Crusade, and you have, again, like that library sequence where, you know, the guy's rubber stamping the things, you know, while he's trying to break through, which is just, feels almost like a Chuck Jones character and be just rendered with peoples, and you know, and it's interesting to kind of see it, to see that experimentation begin here. So rad.
And just thinking about headspace for Zemeckis when this is coming out, because he got a pass on I Want to Hold Your Hand, was appreciated by the studio, got licensed to go make another thing. He's written a script for the hottest director in town with all of the resources he could possibly imagine. It's going to be an enormous hit. Christmas 1979, and mm-hmm. then he's busy finishing Used Cars, I assume, at that time, because mm-hmm. that was released in the summer of 1980. So, like, what are those mm-hmm. months leading up to yep. this? Just those 7 months, if you think about them, it's like he's made it. It's everything's going to change. It's going to be really awesome. Then the movie tests poorly. Then it is a flop. Not a flop, just mm-hmm. a disappointment. It made money. And then mm-hmm. the test screening for Used Car is going super well. So it's like, okay, the car is going to leap over the train and I'm there. Yep. And then, of course, that is a flop as well. So it's like, oh.
Yep.
I feel yep. like almost like Taylor Kitsch, the summer of... he had an Oliver Stone movie, Battleship, and John Carter. All yes. in the same 6 months. It was like his career was right there. It's gonna be huge, and then
we are still awaiting Taylor Kitsch's Back to the Future. You know, whenever he gets one, he will rise like a phoenix from the ashes. The actor Taylor Kitsch for Friday Night Lights is who we're talking about.
But will he play the doctor?
Just like
the
Bob
Marty?
Zemeckis.
That's true.
We don't know. Or will he
direct?
That's what I want to see. I want to see Taylor Kitsch direct a time travel movie. Come on, Richard. We can make that happen.
I mean, he's close to you.
It's true. In Austin. Here we are. Yeah. Man, you know, I wish I had more to say about 1941, honestly, but it's like you very quickly see that it's a series of wonderful and delightful moments that all feel a bit kind of crowded, and you spend a lot of the film frustrated picturing the better movie you want to see. But you know, I think maybe the hardest part is that more so than most other Spielberg movies and most other Robert Zemeckis movies, I didn't think much about it after it was over, and I don't remember much about it now that it's done. And I think that you realize that as much as we marvel at these fantastic shots and sequences and stunts and all of those things, that they need a couple of actual characters and an actual goal, real world to be able to anchor to at some point in order for any of those things to have any life or heat or warmth in your mind at all. So, yeah.
We've spent an hour talking and we've not really touched on the fact that there's a story or characters.
Yeah.
It's all just weird details.
Doesn't really count. We talked about the Toshiro Mifune submarine. That's about the only plot there is. It's there. Eventually it attacks. John Belushi flies around the plane. There's a bunch of little people on the ground who squabble and do some dances and stuff. That's about it.
Well, it's a delight. That's the thing is, the plot is actually delightful. But the problem is, if you actually state the plot out loud, it sounds like a rad fucking movie. You know, it's like Ned Beatty defending Toshiro Mifune and Christopher Lee in a submarine. That sounds like the best fucking movie ever. But to say the plot out loud is a little bit more exciting than the experience of watching the movie. Just because I think it honestly felt a bit more, the experience felt a bit more frustrating than satisfying the whole time. So, yeah. Word.
I mean, it does, but I think my favorite part, you asked this before, I think my favorite part was Dan Aykroyd's line, they sunk our tank and Ferris wheel, sir. They sunk our tank and Ferris wheel. That worked.
One of my one of my favorite lines was when they are about to shoot the Ferris wheel, and he says, "Fire at that industrial structure."
Yes. Because, of course, the Japanese are not cheery enough to know what a Ferris wheel is.
Yes, that's right.
Toshiro Mifune's way too grim.
Goddamn Toshiro Mifune in this film. An embarrassment of riches, this goddamn movie.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. That's and a lot of planes.
A lot of planes, yeah.
And Warren Oates.
Oh, yeah, Warren Oates. I want to hear those guns. That's a Spielberg Milius thing right there. I want to hear them.
Yep. And there's some Milius in there right for you. Warren Oates, you goddamn son of a bitch. Yeah. No, it's an interesting one. I wish I had stronger opinions one way or the other about it, but it is an assemblage of delightful beats, kind of.
Is this why nobody ever talks about it?
Yep. It just sort of feels transparent, which, if anything, that is the big takeaway, that you could spend that much money and have that cast and spend that kind of money, spend that kind of scope. You can throw all of that in an audience and it can still feel a little bit hollow and transparent if it doesn't have sound fundamentals. Or if they end up getting just cropped out of the movie because it's overlong or whatever, you know. But still, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, lessons. It's a thing. Lessons. I think this is the last big one that he wrote, I think, for somebody else. I think there's another movie in 92 that I'd never heard of called Trespass, which who knows if that'll ever get watched. And then they've got story credit, I think, on Bordello of Blood.
We'll visit that one eventually on another episode.
But did we talk this one out?
I think we may have talked out 1941.
Great. I'm tired of talking about it. I've said literally everything I can.
Yeah. Yes, that's
sad,
all I got.
But it just doesn't have too much more to say about it. Sadly,
This is not to say that I didn't enjoy watching it. I enjoyed watching it as a fantastic nexus of everything that was that cultural moment all crashing together. It's a little bit of Star Wars and a little bit of Milius and a little bit of Zemeckis and a little bit of Animal House and a little bit of fucking prelude to Airplane and a little bit of everything.
Almost a musical. It's got a musical number.
Exactly. So
it's sort of like Kentucky Fried Movie. Sort of like Kentucky Fried Movie with a much, much, much bigger budget.
Mm-hmm. Yes. In fact, if this had just been a series of skits instead, if this had been some sort of anthology, it honestly may have been more to what Spielberg was trying to do than what Zemeckis was trying to do. But a critical part of the Zemeckis puzzle we have filled in here, Richard.
I agree. And kind of a fun exercise to imagine what the movie is like if he gets to make the one that he wrote. I'd be curious to find that screenplay, actually. And just get a read through. One more thought that I read that I think is worth sharing is based on 1941. Apparently, studios didn't want Spielberg to direct Raiders of the Lost Ark.
It makes sense.
He almost didn't get that one, apparently, or at least it was not as easy as getting this one. Which is crazy. And of course, he brought Raiders in under schedule because apparently Lucas was like, "Look, this is my money. Like, you got to be on time." And so he was, because Lucas is a friend.
Rad.
And fuck the studios.
That's right.
Man. That's the episode.
We did it. We have another fun bonus prelude episode from our quarantine states.
Excellent.
Okay, yeah. And the intro music was Brian Satterwhite.
Brian!
Which we've yet to hear all of it yet, but we've heard part of it. It's great. And then I'm at Bob Zemeckis on Instagram. That's how you can follow the show. Kyle, where can they follow you?
I am at Mr. Kyle Bogart, Mr. Kyle Bogart on Instagram. And Cliff, where can we find you?
You can find me at Cliff Bogart on Instagram.
All right, that's it. I don't know what the next episode is, but later, buttheads!
Later!